Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Janine Green ASB Chats. Today I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Joe Grimshaw from Surrey Police. And we've titled, I mean, Joe has a huge amount of experience in antisocial behaviour, and I probably could have picked any number of topics to explore during this episode. But one of the things that Joe has, in my opinion, really been at the forefront in terms of addressing, tackling, partnership working around is cuckooing. And so for me, the real obvious focus for this session was that particular subject. So this podcast episode is entitled Janine Green ASB Chats Cuckooing. As you, hopefully this is not the first time listening to one of my podcast episodes. If it is your first time, then a huge welcome. I think I always forget to introduce myself. So for those of you that I've not met or spoken to before, my name's Janine Green. I've worked in antisocial behaviour and community safety for around 15 years now. And one of the things that I'm really passionate about is sharing best practice, sharing what works, sharing some of the solutions to some of the common problems that we come across as practitioners. And my aim with these podcast episodes is to always ensure that not only do you hopefully get an interesting conversation, but that you also come out with some real practical tips, advice, guidance that can hopefully make a real impact and a difference to frontline activity, how we address some of these ASB issues, and hopefully how we can better support victims and reduce harm that's being caused. So that's a little bit about me. As I said, absolutely delighted to invite Joe along today. I know from many webinars and presentations that we've done together that Joe will have some incredibly useful information to share with us this morning. So not that I'm setting the bar of expectation incredibly high, Joe, but I just really, I suppose, want to start by saying welcome and just asking you to just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit more about what you do.
Yeah, well, thanks, Jean. That's a bar well set high, but I will try and do my best to kind of make sure I meet it and above. Yeah, so I started at Surrey Police 18 years ago on a 2-year contract with some funding from the then Labour government under Tony Blair as an ASBO case builder that some of your listeners may remember all those kind of years ago, and I suppose it was a bit of a kind of a leap of faith for me in a 2-year contract, but my plan was probably to stay for 2, and I've been here for 18 and continue to enjoy what I'm doing nearly every day, kind of tackling antisocial behaviour. So I started off right at the beginning 18 years ago with just having 2 areas of Surrey to look after as the ASBO case builder, with the main thrust of my kind of job description to get ASBOs, but very, very quickly, once I'd learned what an ASBO was, of course, because there weren't many people around 18 years ago that really understood the legislation, that actually enforcement is not the only way of tackling antisocial behaviour, and actually prevention and intervention are as important, or if not more important, to be honest. Yeah, let's stop people being victims before that, the harm is caused. So over the years, I was promoted to look after the whole of West Surrey, which was 4 boroughs, and with that came some extra staff to help me deal with the issues. 5 years ago, I was asked to then look at ASB from a force perspective, so I became the force's ASB manager. And part of my role at that time was to get the force fit for purpose with the new legislation coming in 2014, and to look at our strategy and our operational kind of tactics in regards to antisocial behaviour, ensure that our staff were suitably trained and could identify antisocial behaviour and what they could do to tackle it. And then also as part of that was to get the partners involved. For those that don't know Surrey is 2-tiered authority. So I have 11 districts and boroughs. What I didn't want to do when the new ASB legislation came in, to find out that actually we were doing it at least 11 different ways because of the localism. So again, part of my role in 2013 was to get a partnership framework to look at the new legislation that was coming in. And touch wood, that framework is still working today and still ensures that there's a partnership response to tackling ASB. As part of that force management, I also have the line management of 8 ASB specialists. They are civilian officers who are experts in the field of tackling antisocial behaviour. And they look after all of the court work, all the applications that we'll do, but also they support and advise predominantly our safer neighbourhood teams, although in the last 2 or 3 years, we have been doing more work with our public protection teams and our serious and organised crime teams. Just because, again, the flexibility of the ASB legislation really helps to tackle some of those more serious crimes that are happening in our communities. And then more recently, I've just been promoted. So as of January, I took over as head of antisocial behaviour and partnerships as part of the new problem solving and prevention team that Surrey Police have brought into place, which, it says what it says on the tin, prevention and problem solving, but as well as keeping the antisocial behaviour portfolio and the specialists, I now have a ASB sergeant who helps me with the operational tactical delivery of antisocial behaviour, which allows me to be more strategic in my thinking and to make sure that we are ahead of the game when it comes to what's going on in our communities. And as part of that portfolio, I now have the oversight of our 22 youth engagement officers as part of a piece of work around engagement with children and young people. So it's been a journey. I've been allowed to grow and to thrive, which I'm kind of really grateful for. So yes, 2 years is now 18.
I love that. So many people can probably relate to that kind of, like, you know, work plan of, I'm going to be here for 3 years and then I'm going to move on. And then
exactly.
30 years later, you're kind of taking your pension and trying to work out what's happened. I suppose I should also give a huge congratulations on the recent promotion as well, although it sounds like there's a huge amount to fit into the role that you're doing. But I think what I really love when I talk to you, Jo, when I hear about some of the stuff that you're up to is the real importance and focus that Surrey Police put on ASB, which I'm not sure... Perhaps I'm talking from the outside that all police forces maybe share quite the same level of priority that's placed on ASB.
No, I think, you know, that is a shame. But what I would say is they have always been supportive. They've always listened. They've, you know, and they understand the harm. And I think sometimes, you know, without wanting to use the words that we're not meant to use, it's low level. Mm. It doesn't have an impact. But actually in Surrey, and I suppose that they are lucky, whether they think they're lucky, they have a me that can actually take the time to focus on mm-hmm. it, to understand the issue, to look at what's going on around the rest of the country and bring that best practice in mm-hmm. to Surrey. Mm-hmm. Whereas other forces, they will have police officers who will maybe hold that portfolio for a couple of years and then get promoted to somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So you then have a new police officer looking after that role. You know, and potentially that person could change twice in a year. So I think one of the really positive things, whilst being here 18 years sounds like a long time, I have been here for 18 years. I'm not going anywhere. So especially for the partner agencies, I am that kind of constant person.
And I think that's, I mean, when I go out and talk to practitioners and you kind of, you know, that, you know, what three things are the biggest challenges in ASB casework? And inevitably, you know, nearly 100% of people will respond back with partnership working. And when you kind of pick that a little bit more, it is very often the changing people and, you know, almost feeling like you're getting somewhere with building those relationships and then having to start at scratch again because of the turnaround. So I'm sure if you ever announced that you were leaving Surrey, there would be some very, very disappointed people. I want to kind of move on then to look at, because as I mentioned in the introduction, I know that obviously you do a lot of work around many different elements of ASB. And, you know, what I've always found really interesting, any conversations that we've had has been around, you know, that real recognition of how wide the definition of ASB reaches. And actually, we, you know, as you say, we can use these tools to tackle some behaviours that we would probably automatically think of being quite serious criminality, but we can use the ASB tools to good effect with those as well. And I suppose cuckooing is one example of that, because I guess if you went out and spoke to sort of a lay person on the street and described to them what cuckooing was, their automatic assumption would be, and correctly, that it's a serious crime and therefore it's the criminal powers that deal with it. And I think what we've seen, and particularly through the work that you've done, that actually the civil toolkit, the ASB powers, have a large role to play. But before we kind of start unpicking and getting into the detail, I think it's just useful to make sure that we're all on the same page. I'm conscious that perhaps some of our listeners might come from more of a housing background or maybe more of a voluntary sector background, and perhaps might have heard of the term cuckooing, but, you know, might be sitting there listening and going, I'm not quite sure what cuckooing means. So I just wonder if you could start by providing us a bit of a definition around what you consider cuckooing to be, and maybe some of the common examples that you've seen of how the problem plays out in reality.
Yeah, definitely. So we use the term cuckooing, and I think it's been around for a while. But what I try and do now when I'm talking to people is talk about it in regards to it's the exploitation of vulnerable people. Mm. And I think sometimes just by using the word cuckooing, it kind of maybe downplays it a little bit. But the main thing that connects any victim of cuckooing or exploitation is that they have a property, they live somewhere. Without that, it's a different type of exploitation. But normally what tends to happen from a Surrey's perspective, it's normally drug dealers that will take over that property. They will take over that property for the sole purpose of using it to either deal from or to store or to basically sort out and kind of wrap up and kind of deal with it from there and allow people to use it. It's again from a Surrey point of view is mostly county lines, so it's our out of force drug lines that will come in, but we do have local drug lines who also exploit individuals within their properties, and they will use as any type of exploitation, they will use many kind of means to get into the property, but once they're in, they won't leave. They will use excuses as of I'm homeless. Again, a lot of the people that we deal with have had a history of homelessness. Mm-hmm. So again, they use that as a way of kind of trying to get some sympathy and get in the door, because, you know, I suspect as a homeless person, if somebody's presented to you on a cold winter's night and saying they've got nowhere to live, you're going to have an understanding, you're going to have an empathy, so you let them in. Yeah. Fortunately, once they're in, they then invite their mate and their mate's mates and then another mate. And actually, they're not mates, they're drug dealers. And once they're in and you ask them to leave, they won't leave. And they will use threats of force and force.
And I think that's some of the challenge, isn't it? Because I think where these people are picking on those that are most vulnerable, perhaps, you know, isolated mental health issues, you know, some kind of substance dependency or whatever, you know, initially those people think that this is a friendship, that, you know, this is the answer to those loneliness problems and that these people are there to be their friend. And then, therefore they would kind of willingly let them through the door. And then, as you say, once they're unfortunately in the door, it's really difficult to get them out then. And I think that's where tact changes a little bit, doesn't it? It becomes about threats of violence or hooking them on drugs or, you know, whatever. Yeah.
It's a type of grooming and they're very good at it. Is another way, you know, of seeing how they work. They know the right buttons to push, and they use that. It's the difference between friend versus friendly. Again, when we talk to victims, sometimes we have to spend quite a lot of time actually talking to them about it's not an appropriate relationship. They're not your friend. Mm-hmm. They're just being friendly because they want to get into your property. They want to use what's yours, you know, mm-hmm. It can be really hard, especially if somebody is socially isolated, they haven't got many friends. It can be really hard to kind of tease them away and actually reassure them and support them that actually that they can make some better. And I don't want to say choices, because there is no choice when it comes to cuckooing, but they can make some changes that will keep them away from the exploitation and make them a bit more resilient to it.
Yeah, and I think, again, this is a huge part of the problem, isn't it? Is that, you know, in these kind of situations, they are incredibly complex, and then therefore you kind of end up with a multitude of victims. You know, you've got the residents that might be suffering from some of the kind of consequences of the property being cuckooed. But then, of course, you've also got the tenant who has, or the resident who's kind of being exploited. And I think sometimes it's quite a challenge to balance up the needs of those kind of number of different victims. I suppose what I'd be really interested to talk a little bit about is kind of exploring some of the impact that cuckooing has on those different types of people. So what kind of impact do you see on the community when there's issues of cuckooing, as well as the kind of impact that you have on the exploited person themselves?
Yeah, so probably for a long while, the time that we know that there's an issue of cuckooing is when the community starts to complain to us, mm-hmm. and report the antisocial behaviour. Before then, it's gone on behind closed doors. And, you know, we have to look at kind of how we try and get in there earlier. But in regards to when we actually come across a property, in regards to the victim, so that the tenant or the resident within that property, what we tend to find is when we go in there and actually realise that they're not the problem, that they've lost control of their property. That's why there's antisocial behaviour at that address. We find people in crisis. Again, you might not believe this in Surrey, but we have people who are starving. So they may be vulnerable themselves and may have a carer that comes in and fills the fridge and the cupboards once a week. they're not getting to eat that food because the exploiters that are in there are eating that food. So we've had people who are really hungry, and actually, from a community point of view, in one example, we had reports that people were going through the bins at night. We presumed at the time that maybe people were storing drugs in there or dropping off drugs. Actually, when we got into that property, what we found out was actually it was the tenant who was actually going out in the middle of the night trying to find food in neighbours' bins, because none of the food that they were being provided with was actually getting to them. So horrendous kind of things going on. We've had people, again, a common trait we see is that the exploiters will take over the beds and the sofas, and we've had people sleeping in kitchens in dog baskets or out in the shed because they've basically been told you're not welcome in the house, or you're not welcome in this part of the house, so you go and sleep somewhere else. We've had issues where people are forced into actually becoming part of that drug dealing. So they're made to go out and sell the drugs or to cut the drugs up and get them ready for being sold. Or that they're kind of forced to go out to shoplift or commit other crimes to, again, bring some income into the County Lines group that have taken over that property. And what we also tend to see is a disengagement from services. So where people maybe were involved with a drug and alcohol worker or a housing officer, they're, you know, the whole grooming side of this exploitation is, you know, you don't need to be talking to these people anymore. You know, we're your friends. We can provide you with your crack and heroin. You don't need to go and get some sort of replacement for it. So, again, people are very much in poor health when we get to them. So, and again, this all happens behind closed doors. So it's very much about how do we kind of ensure that police officers, partner agencies, housing officers kind of understand that maybe when they go into one of these properties to have a look around and kind of see that maybe everything's not all right, and that actually that tenant probably won't tell you that they're being exploited. You know, as with any type of exploitation, the hardest thing is to get someone to open up. So that's kind of what we see inside the property. Outside the property, what tends to happen is that there's not such a thing as an orderly drug house. Whilst it might start off quite quietly, by virtue of the people that attend it and visit it, you know, they don't really care about the property. They don't care about the bins overflowing, the drugs paraphernalia in the garden. They will have fights with each other. They will have fights with rival gangs that involve knives, guns, all going on out in the community or inside. Criminal damage. So, it's, again, this is where it kind of manifests to our community who some of them will be strong enough to let us know. Some will suffer in silence. And when my team go out and take statements or go out with the police officer to take statements, it's heartbreaking when they come back and I read them to see that people have been living like this for a couple of years because they've been too scared. And to be honest, I kind of hear what they're saying. You know, if I was living next to one of those, would I really want to phone the police or my housing officer and tell them what was going on? But I think at some point, you know, the line is crossed. And unfortunately, if we don't know, if people don't tell us, we can't really do anything about it. But with those statements that we get as part of the kind of closure orders application that we do, you know, what we find is that we have residents in the community who are on antidepressants. They're on sleeping tablets because they can't sleep because of what's going on. And this isn't just people that live next door. These are people kind of three or four down the road or around the corner. It's not just about those that are kind of the neighbor, you know, the real neighbors. We have people who don't let their grandkids visit. So they haven't seen their grandkids for 6 months. So they haven't had friends around because they're so embarrassed about the noise and the behaviour that's coming next door. They don't want to have friends around, you know, for a meal or for a barbecue. They don't use their gardens because of all the noise that's coming from the properties. But what we've also had is where people have lost jobs. Because they're not sleeping. So an example was we had a victim who worked in a factory and part of their job was to produce X amount of units an hour. They hadn't been sleeping. So when they got to work, they weren't actually being able to kind of perform that role. And whilst, you know, they did tell their boss what the problem was, you know, they kind of said, if you don't perform, you haven't got a job.
Yeah.
And that person actually lost their job because they couldn't actually perform at work because of what was going on at home. We've also had examples where we've had people living in flats around a cuckoo property who have started up WhatsApp groups. So when it's bin day, they all WhatsApp each other when they're ready to go down. So they all put the bins out together. You know, it's just unacceptable behaviour. It's not the way people should have to live.
It's not. I think there's a real responsibility here on officers who put case files together because, you know, there's you know, as you've just said, there might be that these problems have been going on for years and there becomes a tipping point where no matter how scared a resident is of repercussion, the need to get the problem solved becomes the priority. And it's therefore really, really important that when somebody does get to that point and is brave enough to report it to the police or the local authority, their housing, that there is a response to that and there is a recognition of how serious it is. And also that when, you know, you talk so kind of eloquently there about like really heartbreaking impact that these problems have, you know, to the point, I think, bizarrely, of all those examples you gave, the one that hit me the hardest was the WhatsApp group, because something as minor as putting your bin out, you have to coordinate such a response to it to be strong enough to do those things because you're living your life so fearfully and so limited. And it's so important that when we're putting statements together to support any legal action, that we recognise that that kind of contextual impact information is just as important almost as the actual behaviour that's going on itself. And I just think, to me, there's such a responsibility on officers to get the work right, because there's so much at risk if the work isn't right.
Definitely. It's, you know, when people tell us we have to act, you know, and that can't be weeks and weeks away,
no.
Especially when people are living like this. So you need to have something in place that triggers some responses when those communities actually kind of come and talk to you. And what we find is that once you've done something, the community start to trust you again, or to realise that actually you can do something. And again, talking about the legislation, the really good thing about the legislation is the use of hearsay evidence.
Mm.
So again, one of the main ways we get that evidence is we don't actually disclose any names when we go to court for a closure order. It's either the officer giving it as part of their evidence, or it's depersonalized and we talk about resident A, resident B.
But again, and, talking about the toolkit, and I know we've spoken about this before, and I know we share the exact same frustrations. There are things that aren't quite right with the toolkit. We get that. And there are some, you know, wish lists of things that we'd like to change. But bottom line is the tools are there to deal with these problems very quickly. And where there are issues like you have described, there is absolutely no excuse for those type of issues to go unaddressed for a very long. And I know you absolutely share that view. And I know you've got examples of where you've kind of been in court for closure orders within literally hours of the incidents being reported to you. And I guess where I get really frustrated and really upset, actually, is where I hear about really serious issues of ASB that have been going on for months, because the legislation is there to prevent that from being the case.
Definitely. We have had those conversations, we've had those rants and rahs. I think from a social perspective, why it works better than elsewhere is we do have that team of specialists. So they are fully aware of what is needed evidentially, but more importantly, because they're in court quite regular, they have a really good working relationship with our legal team, so with our legal provider, but also with the courts. So the courts understand if we're coming and saying I need a court hearing, I need to speak to a magistrate or a district judge within the next 24 hours, we can get that. Now, whilst people kind of say that's one in a million, it's not. It's about building relationships. It's about making sure people understand. And from our point of view, we've also is understanding, you know, what do the courts require from us? So actually when we get there, we have everything ready to go, and we're not seen as a kind of hindrance of here comes the ASB team with another rush job. We've got all of the evidence that we need in a particular order so that we can go in there quickly. But you're right, if one of these addresses is highlighted to you, you know, whilst 24 hours is fantastic, 2 weeks is probably enough time for you to kind of get into your residence to kind of reassure them that actually they tell you their story, you can tell it for them to a magistrate. And what magistrate is not really going to give us some type of order when, you know, we're describing some of those things I described earlier that are impacting on the tenant and on the community. So you need to make sure you have some robust kind of guidance or operating procedures that you work to. And it's not just whilst police we apply for these orders. If we're talking about social landlords, you know, our expectation is that the landlord will look at the tenancy, you know, but so we don't kind of look at it and say that's a social housing landlord's property, they can deal with it. Because people are still being harmed. And as we know, and that's one of the kind of the things we talk about constantly is around why haven't social landlords been given this piece of legislation, because I think it would really help them. But I know from talking to some of the housing providers that they really struggle because they're asking the police to actually put the order in to give some instant respite while they deal with it longer term, and they're being told no, we can't do it, or it'll take a few months. So again, it's building those relationships up so that actually everybody understands what their role is in this, and you know what the outcome is, which is basically to stop the behaviour in the first place.
And there's a few things of what you said there that I just want to unpick and highlight. Ooh. I think it's really important. And I think one of the things you kind of said is that, you know, you've got great processes and procedures in place, but they didn't just appear one day. You had to put the work in to get them in place. And, you know, if somebody is listening thinking, well, you know, we haven't got the processes to do these things within 24 hours, you might not have now, but that doesn't stop you from working towards a position where you have. And I know, Joe, you have the same view as me about, you know, really wanting to share what works, best practice and stuff. And I guess my plea therefore to anyone listening who is thinking this isn't possible for us is please just reach out either to myself or Joe, because I know that we'd be more than happy to kind of help you to try and overcome some of those challenges and obstacles. I think the other thing that I wanted to pick out, Joe, is that, we have used the language tenants quite a lot, and I think that's understandable because I think we do find that, a significant amount of the problems that we're talking about do happen within social housing properties because, we know the way the allocation process works. We know that we have, we don't have enough social housing. We've got long waiting lists, and we know therefore that allocation policies are very often about who is most in need, and therefore those who are vulnerable are more likely to be housed in social housing, but unfortunately they're also the people that are more likely to be exploited. And one of the elements that you picked up there, which is, but unfortunately social housing providers don't have access to the full toolkit in terms of things like closure orders, and therefore that need to have that real partnership working. But I think, there is a massive role for housing providers to play. I mean, one of the things that you said probably about 10 minutes ago, which I noted down, was, about that kind of professional curiosity. It's about, if you have something reported to you, like somebody going through the bins, that we don't just make that automatic assumption of what the reason behind that is, that we use our professional curiosity to really sort of start to understand. And also the value of using our kind of contractors, the people that are going into properties, that are maybe doing the gas inspections, that are doing some repair work, that we train them to recognize some of the signs that might suggest that there are problems. Some of the things that you mentioned, Joe, in terms of, people sleeping in, dog beds, I think was one of the example you used, or people having no food, or, those signs that the people from housing that are going in could then pass back to housing so that there's that kind of identification of an issue at the earliest possible stage. And I know you do quite a lot of work, Joe, don't you, around working with housing to try and almost proactively identify vulnerable properties?
Yeah, so you're spot on there, and it is that training and awareness. So again, I suppose being in the position that I'm in, kind of sitting on that partnership response to antisocial behaviour, it allows me to offer up training and awareness kind of raising, and we do that in all sorts of different ways. So again, if someone kind of says to me, "Can you come out and have a chat with my team?" We will do that, but we also have our practitioners forums twice a year where we kind of raise the issue. We have a partnership email which has a monthly update where again we can push out any kind of new trends. So again, in regards to kind of the whole exploiting kind of cuckooing, we know that the County Lines drug dealers, as much as your listeners are listening today about what we're doing, they also are listening and seeing what we're doing, and the fact that we can go in quite quickly in Surrey. And what we're finding now is actually they have three or four properties on the go and switch between them to try and minimize the impact they're having on there and to try and hide. So it is really important around that awareness training. And I will give you an example. I'll give a big shout out to Raven Housing, who have a lunchtime kind of CPD kind of event where you eat your sandwiches and they get an expert in to kind of talk about their area of expertise, and I did it around kind of cuckooing hour, and there was everyone there from the housing support to the estate managers to the guys that do the gas inspections. And again, you never know when you've been there for an hour, kind of actually whether you make a difference. But actually, probably about a month later, one of the workers that went into a gas inspection came back and said, "I think this person's being cuckooed." They were, and we were able to go in quickly and sort the problem out for it. So I'm a big believer is that we have to show not just our partners and our officers, but also the public what they should be looking at. So again, we're doing quite a bit of work with Neighbourhood Watch to get them to understand what they're seeing, because again, you may be seeing things, but you don't actually know what they equate to. So it could be people coming and going all times of the day and night, or it could be you may just think they're a popular person, but if only that person's only staying for like 4 or 5 minutes, actually there's probably an indication that something else is going on in there. So we need to also upskill our communities so that, one, they can understand what they're seeing, and two, that they know that they can access us to actually do something about it if they tell us.
Yeah, it's that confidence again, isn't it? And I think
Mm.
the thing with I've had some conversations sometimes with clients about, gas contractors, etc., being a little bit reluctant, scared almost to, because they feel that what they're being asked to do is diagnose the problem and, they're not support workers, they're not social care. And I think it's that reassuring them that what we're not asking them to do is become safeguarding experts.
No.
We're just asking them to look out for certain things that probably without the training, their guts would have been telling them that something was wrong anyway. We're just giving them permission to follow those gut instincts and report it back to somebody who does have the specialist knowledge to diagnose that problem. Because I think the other thing is we've spoken about this so many times about, compartmentalizing issues. So, you might have 10 forums going on in a local authority that are discussing the same person or the same families in all 10 forums because issues cross over and intersect with each other so much. And, the signs that you might see that there's cuckooing going on might be some of the same signs that you might see if domestic abuse is going on or modern day slavery or all those kind of big ticket things that we know are, and rightly so, are priority areas in community safety. So we don't want the contractor to be labelling the problem. We just want them to be recognising those signs and bringing them back.
Definitely. I mean, I always kind of end any sort of training is if it doesn't look right, it doesn't smell right, it probably isn't right. But what we need to make sure is that people, as you quite rightly say, have somewhere where they can just go back and say, I don't think this feels right. Over to you. And once you have that, that's as much as you really want that person to do. Other than again, I'm a great one for feedback. So again, we went back to that member of staff to say you made a real difference there by identifying that problem.
Yeah, no, that's yeah, I love that kind of feedback loop. I just want to move on because we've kind of touched a little bit on the closure powers, and I want to kind of move on then to look at some of the tools that we use to deal with issues at cuckooing. And I think some of the traditionally where we might perhaps have gone wrong, and again, I'm talking about where it's issues in social housing, is that we've kind of applied a very traditional approach to tenancy enforcement. And what we've done is we've gone, well, the tenant has voluntarily invited or, voluntarily allowed these people into his property, and the tenant signs a tenancy agreement where they take responsibility for the visitors or their household members. And therefore, the answer is that the tenant's breaching the tenancy agreement, and therefore we should go down the lines of possession. And I think that approach, we know that as a sector that approach isn't appropriate now because of all the reasons that we've already spoken about, Joe, with the fact that, we've got a multitude of victims and the tenants themselves are being exploited. So actually, how is the solution to evict a vulnerable person? How is that really resolving the issue? And so I'm interested to hear a little bit more about, how you've used some of the other tools like the closure orders, particularly as a way of kind of supporting the tenant as well as stopping the problems to the community. I just didn't know if you had any examples to share around some of the tools that you've used.
So I think one of the positives that came out of the 2014 Act was the amendment to the closure order. So for those that don't know or don't remember, is that prior to 2014, if we were going down a closure order route, it was everybody out or nobody out, basically. So if you closed it, everyone had to kind of leave the property. And I suppose for me at the time and now, that didn't really feel comfortable to evict someone who actually has been exploited, because it's not their fault, so, as you say. And it's not just social housing. I have social workers and homelessness prevention officers that tell me, well, they invited the people in, so they're as much of the problem. But it's a lifestyle choice is one I hear quite a lot. And I kind of always reply with, it's not a lifestyle choice to sleep in a dog's basket and scratch around for food. Because the people inside the property, how even though you've invited them in, have got some force and coercive behaviour over you, and to make them homeless is not going to sort the issue out. So the 2014 Act, ASB Crime Policing Act, allowed us to ask the courts to consider what we call a partial closure. And that being that we could leave the tenant or the person. And again, the good thing about this legislation is tenure neutral. And actually you can use it on a piece of land in the way that the Act describes a premise. But we have seen properties that are owned by people. So again, not so often, but what we have had is elderly parents who have been cuckooed by their children. The children have been away from the property for a while, have come back for whatever reason. They have a drug issue. They invite drug dealers into the property. They're normally quite large properties. Mum, dad are kind of forced to kind of live in one part of the house, and the rest is taken over by those drug dealers. But the good thing about this legislation, it doesn't matter what those four walls look like. It could be a shed, could be a caravan, it could be a telephone kiosk. As long as you have the nuisance and the antisocial behaviour linked to it, you can use this legislation. But going back to that point, the really good thing about it for me is that we now can partially close it, which means that we can keep the bad people out, keep the exploited person in there and work with that exploited person. And this is, again, one of the big things I push is that the closure order is just part of the problem solving process. It gives you time to breathe and it gives you time to work with those individuals and with the community to make them more resilient, because the maximum time you can put one of these orders on is 6 months. Now, whilst you can do it for 6 months, if the behaviour then returns, you can then go and have another one. So a house can have multiple applications for a closure order. So especially those where the person owns the property, so you know they've got a mortgage on it, etc., they will have to go back at the end of 6 months. But what you can do is if they go back after 6 months and they haven't learned their lesson, you can apply again. But that's kind of not the way you really want to do it. But so it's a really good way of dealing with any sort of antisocial behaviour.
And I think your sentence there that you said about, you know, it gives you the breathing space, I think that's absolutely key, because I guess the one thing that the closure order brings is that ability to use very quickly. So, you know, probably definitely far quicker than if you were going down the more traditional route of possession. So it's something definitely that we can use very quickly to stop the harm almost immediately. But you're absolutely right. And whenever I deliver training on closure orders, one of the things that I really try to highlight is that it is, you are in these types of cases, you are likely to need to use a number of different tools. So, you know, it might be that, you know, it might be that you are doing a full closure order and therefore the housing need to be looking at serving a notice on the grounds of absolute possession, because obviously we know that a closure notice of property is a condition under the absolute ground. So, you know, and it's things like the timing has to be bang on. So, you know, the minute you get your closure order and, you know, Joe, your team rock up to put the closure order on the front door, that also the housing office is going along at exactly the same time to serve the notice, so that there's no delay in slippage in time, because as we know, getting possession is difficult anyway. So even with the absolute ground, getting it within 6 months is still quite tight. So we want to maximise the chance of doing that as much as possible. Or, you know, as you say, if it's happening in a private premises, then do we need to be looking at getting an injunction or, you know, a CBO or whatever, so that when the problems return, there's still some control measures in place. And I think it's that sometimes perhaps we're guilty of thinking there's that kind of one solution, where actually we need to be thinking quite creatively about using some of these tools in conjunction with each other to get the best result.
Yeah, and you need to be able to police them. That's the other issue. So, you know, you get your closure order on, you will tell your residents, you know, if you see anybody going into this address other than the tenant or the owner, you need to dial in. Now, whilst we can never guarantee you're going to get a response, but that's, you know, especially when you're dialing 3-9s, there may be other things going across the county, but we have to have a response. And what I say to police officers when they kind of come to my team is, can you police this? Because you will very, very quickly undo all the good work you've done by putting that order in if we don't attend and we don't get the bad people out. And also those exploiters will know that we don't mean business. So, okay, they've put a notice on, a court notice on the door, but, you know, we've been in here for the last 3 or 4 days and nobody's come and dealt with us. So you have to, it's not just about getting that court order. It's how you're going to police it. How are you going to let your community know what's going on and how they can tell you what's actually occurring in those premises.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think I used to manage an ASB team at a council, as you well know. And I mean, it was the premises closure order back then that we were using because it was before 2014. But I used to say to my officers, those residents are never going to love you more than when you first put the closure order in place. But if you miss the extension date and forget to make the application for the extension, or at the end of the 6 months, the problems just come back, or you aren't able to police it and therefore it looks to be an empty threat, you'll be worse than back at square one, because the next time that you go out to a resident to try and get information from them, they're just going to go, well, what is the point?
Yeah.
So I think you are absolutely right with that. I know there is going to be quite a few people listening coming from a social housing background, and I know that probably some of them will be sitting here thinking, do you know what, we absolutely can see the benefit of closure orders in tackling these kind of issues. Our problem is that we can't use them ourselves, mm-hmm. and we can't get the buy-in from either the police or the local authority to work with us. And so therefore we're having to either look at injunction applications, potentially multiple injunctions, you know, or we are going to have to go down the lines of possession, because as lovely as we'd love to use the closure order, but we can't. Have you got any advice that you would give for somebody who is sat there thinking those things? Any tips for trying to engage partners?
Yeah, and I suppose let's start with the nice engage to start off with, which is again around trying to get some sort of partnership meeting together to kind of discuss the frustrations and the kind of experiences that you as a social housing provider kind of experiencing, how your hands are tied. Because again, it probably wasn't until Janine's slide I kind of met you a long, long time ago that I kind of realized actually housing probably at the time had a better idea about ASB than we did as police. So I learned quite a lot from kind of housing around how kind of you should be dealing with ASB. But I think again, police officers will just presume that why does it take 6 months, a year to get possession? Mm-hmm. You know, it should happen there and then. So there is a thing about kind of setting expectations. And whilst I can do that now in Surrey, when police officers go, "Oh, Blooming Housing Association," you know, they're direct, you know, there are hoops that have to be jumped. It's whilst I can get quite grumpy when, you know, housing providers haven't maybe served the NOSP and we're kind of 2 months into it, slightly annoying. But, you know, we know that possession, or I know possession, is not going to happen overnight. So we have to give some leeway to the social landlord, really, to kind of be able to do it. So I think there's a bit of work in regards to kind of trying to do it the friendly way.
Yeah.
But it's almost like I would then kind of say you need to escalate it now. Kind of two ways you could do it. I would expect that most counties, most districts and boroughs have some sort of multi-agency problem-solving sort of meeting. So in Surrey, we have a CHARM, which is a community harm risk management meeting, where partners all talk about individuals or victims who don't fit other criteria for MARAC or MAPA, etc., and there's an impact in the community. So again, we talk about community harm rather than antisocial behaviour. So it may be that you put your vulnerable tenant onto that meeting for a discussion to try and get some traction outside of kind of the two agency conversation you're having. Every local authority has to have a community safety partnership. So if you really kind of get into the end of your tether and say, no one's, you know, we're trying our best here, but nobody is helping, is maybe look to find out who the chair of the local community safety partnership is. Again, I think a real disservice to social housing providers is you're not seen as a statutory partner. So under the Crime and Disorder Act, you know, you're not there. You weren't really kind of given any sort of consideration in the ASB Act, 2014 Act. But actually, as an agency, I think you're up there as someone that should be seen as a statutory agency, and maybe that would then afford you a bit more of a foothold into those kind of community safety partnership meetings. But I would, again, if you were getting really desperate, would kind of be the place to go to say, you know, people are being harmed, we're trying our best, however, we do not have the tools and powers available to you that you do. And whilst we don't want you to take on the problem, be the lead, we need your help. And as I said, that's the kind of way we do it in Surrey. I sometimes have officers that will come to me and say, yeah, but it's the housing association, it's their property, they should be dealing with it. Well, yes, and they will deal with it, but they can't do it quickly. And in the meantime, if we don't do something, people will continue to be harmed. And I'm not going to sit here and allow that to happen. We can have conversations after the fact about who should have been doing what and have a debrief, because it's always, you know, we haven't got it 100% correct. We were always learning, as you know, as each and every one of these we do. But, you know, that there has to be that time where we have to do something as police, because we're the only ones with the tools and powers. I think that's kind of where I would, you know, start at that kind of asking for help, and maybe being a bit more knowledgeable around what they can and can't provide as police or the local authority. And then kind of, you know, I hate to kind of say that you ramp it up, but that's why these processes in place. And I think as long as you don't go there screaming and shouting, but actually just go there from the point of, we want some help, one would hope maybe someone higher up the chain might make a decision and actually put some resources to it. Because again, you know, sometimes when you're only asking, say, a PC or a sergeant, you know, they don't have access to budgets and overtime codes, that kind of thing. Whereas the kind of higher you go up and ask, you may actually be able to access that and unlock some additional resource.
I think you've made so many great points there. And I think, you know, that first bit around educating, I think sometimes my last podcast episode was on kind of partnership working collaboration. And one of the things we talked about was how sometimes we can make assumptions about other partners, about why they're doing things and why they're not doing certain things. And so I think that raising awareness of each other's roles, responsibilities, powers, you know, limitations of powers is really, really important. And I suppose I will cheekily make a little bit of a plug here that if you know, if you are a police officer and you want to find out a little bit more about housing, then I would respectfully say that perhaps my textbook would be a really great place to start in terms of understanding a little bit more about the powers that housing providers have. But I also think, aside from that, one of the biggest things that we need to do is about make sure that we really understand, live, breathe, and really walk the walk in terms of what partnership working really means, because partnership working is not about passing the problem onto someone else. Partnership working is about us all coming together to solve the issue. And I think there are going to be people sitting and listening going, well, of course, we know that. But I think there's a difference between knowing it and actually doing it. And I think where I think there is an issue is where potentially some housing providers might be going to the police and saying, can you do a closure order? And perhaps forgetting that they still have a part to play, whether that be in helping to gather the evidence, whether that be in like making sure they serve notices at the right time, you know, whether that might be that they explore an injunction so that if, you know, whatever it is, that there is a role for everybody to play. Mm. But also about making sure that the benefits are sold. So, as I said, it might be, you know, you might assume as a housing officer that the police officer knows everything about the absolute ground for possession. And the police officer knows that if they get a closure order, then that gives some more options down the line. But I think what we're saying is you can't assume that's the case. You know, there will be plenty of police officers that have never heard of the absolute ground for possession before. And I think sometimes if you can kind of show what the benefits are to that agency, they might be more willing to do the little bit of work that comes with what's being asked.
Definitely. And I've always been an advocate whenever I have done any training for our new police officers, or our new recruits, or our PCSOs. The one thing I always advocate is go and have a cup of coffee and a walk around an estate with a housing officer. You will be amazed at the amount of intelligence and information that they hold and potentially don't know that they're holding it. So it's that kind of, it's the local level. So I suppose there's kind of three ways to look at it. It's the local level, kind of officer to officer kind of partnership working and understanding those roles. You've then potentially got your district and boroughs. And again, it's about that next level of managers and what the managers of each of those agencies want to do. And then you've got the county response. And as I said kind of earlier on, 2013, we made a decision, actually, we would have a Surrey response for antisocial behaviour. So we did a lot of work with all of our partner agencies. There was about four or five housing associations on board, schools, youth, about how we would use those tools and powers. And we set out a framework that we all work towards. So again, and I'm just due to kind of refresh it at the moment because wording's changed, etc. But the kind of the framework is still really, really strong. And what it enables you to do is maybe have that cheeky challenge when somebody's not doing what they should be doing and kind of say, look, we all signed up to this framework, you know, and I could have that conversation. Well, you know, why have you not done that? Has something changed? Do we need to change the framework? So, but it's really important to involve everybody when you do that framework, because if you don't involve them, they won't sign up to it. They might sign up to it in regards to ink, but whether they actually sign up to it as a way of working probably won't happen. So it's around whether you do it from a county point of view. And I know sometimes that's hard because, you know, our cousins, our next door neighbours in Sussex, very much wider police force with very much kind of larger kind of districts and boroughs. They're almost their own kind of small county within themselves. It can be quite hard. Mm. And you need someone to manage that.
You know. Yeah. I think one of the things that I'm taking away from this, and it's kind of remind me of, you know, the importance of having the discussions now. So making sure that we're not having to react to a big issue, that we're actually you know, sorting how we're going to work together now, because it's a lot easier to deal with issues, to deal with the manners in which we're going to work before the issues happen. When the issues happen, then we all kind of end up like deers in headlights and rushing around and trying to solve the problem. It's almost too late then to work out the partnership way of working, isn't it?
Well, definitely. The last thing you want to be doing is looking at this as part of a serious case review.
Yes.
You know, and those have happened around the country in regards to kind of cuckoo premises. You know, absolutely. People have been murdered in their homes because of what's going on inside it. So it would make sense to do it while you have the time to do it, or the ability to, rather than doing it on the back of a serious case review, which, you know, every time I see another one, it's so obvious to what the recommendations are.
Yeah.
And should be, which is around stronger partnership, stronger information sharing, understand tools and powers and going in quickly. And again, what I like about the legislation is that you don't have to wait for something to happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, the legislation just talks about the likely soon to result in nuisance disorder, and it's necessary to prevent it from continuing, reoccurring or occurring. All right. And so you have to be quite creative. So we have put closure orders on premises that have not had any antisocial behaviour actually happen at them. We've moved somebody from a cuckooed property to a new property to get them away from the situation they were in, but we felt that we needed an extra piece of enforcement or some legislation just in case they either reverted back to their own kind of type of behavior or the people that were exploiting found out where they were. And because we are experts, we are professionals, we could show to the court that actually, without this order being put on, there was a likelihood that we would have some repeat behaviour. So what we were doing is preventing the tenant or the being re-victimised, but also what we were hoping would happen is that that new community also wouldn't have to have any of that experience that the old community had had.
And again,
it just gives a buffer for that tenant to kind of reintegrate and be a bit more resilient in that new community.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not just about when the problem raises. It's a bit like an iceberg, isn't it? You know, you only see, I think it's 10%, 20% of an iceberg. So the harm that's being done by the time we find it, it can be horrendous. So if we can prevent it from happening at an earlier stage, then be brave and go and do it. Test the courts. You know, and that's probably the first time, well, it's the first time we've ever used it, prevention, but the court were really happy because they could understand and we could show our thinking and that we were doing it because we wanted to prevent it from occurring in this new property.
Yeah, and again,
so don't just...
I think this is, again, about the responsibility on officers to make sure that we understand, you know, the full extent of how these powers can be used, because I think there are probably people that would be quite surprised listening to that, you know, an issue that hadn't happened yet, you know, might never have happened. I mean, chances are that the likelihood is high, otherwise you wouldn't be doing it. But, you know, potentially we haven't got a crystal ball. We don't know. That's definite. But it's about making, as I say, it's about making sure we know the full elasticity of the legislation and use it creatively.
Yeah.
Joe, I'm really sorry to say that we have run out of time.
Can't believe it.
Episodes always fly by, and I have to say I could probably spend genuinely another 3 hours talking to you about this kind of stuff. I have absolutely no doubt that I will be coming back to you and inviting you again on in the future. But I suppose I always like to leave with some sort of takeaways, and I suppose the things that I would really highlight and encourage listeners to go away and think about is, you know, whether they have got those processes in place that the frontline staff are able to recognise these types of issues. You know, is that their professional curiosity there? You know, that need to have those partnership arrangements in place, you know, particularly if you are a housing provider and you haven't got legal recourse to the closure ward yourself, getting those partnership processes in place. And I suppose also that last bit is about really understanding the breadth and, you know, creative and wonderful ways that this legislation can be used. And I suppose a personal plea is, you know, let's not let these types of issues run and run. The legislation is there. And, you know, there are lots and lots of people like myself, like Joe, that are always happy to answer any questions and any queries and share any best practice about what works. Joe, I'm just leaves me to say a massive, massive thank you for coming along today. I've really enjoyed the discussion, and I have no doubt that listeners will have got a huge amount from it. So thank you.
Thank you.
And I suppose just before we leave, just to say a huge thank you to everybody listening as well. It's always lovely to know that I'm not speaking to an empty room. So your feedback means a huge deal to me. Also, if you have any thoughts about future topics you'd like to be covered, future guests, I mean, if you'd like to put yourself forward as a guest, I'm always looking for people to come along and chat to me. Reach out through the normal means. So my website, janinegreenasb.co.uk, my email address, janine@janinegreenasb.co.uk, or you can find me on Twitter and LinkedIn. Until next time, thank you.